John Herron for AM 1290.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel, and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Deckers, makers of Uggs and Tevas, Pialafon Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines, Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years, Habitat for Humanity, building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter, and CSU Channel Islands. No matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. And we're excited today to have as our guest Dr. Sean Anderson, who's a professor at CSU Channel Islands and the incoming chair of the Environmental Science and Resource Management Program. But before we get to Dr. Anderson, we have two special guests from AHA. And if you are a listener to the show, you have heard our theme, which you just heard now, and Tina Cholesky, who is a singer-songwriter and probably the best guitarist and singer in Santa Barbara, wrote our theme. And she also participates in the signature event that AHA has every year called Sing It Out. And we have with us today Melissa Block, who's the grant writer for AHA, and Brandon Battle, who is a facilitator at AHA, who are participating in this year's Sing It Out, which is this Sunday. So welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about Sing It Out. Sing It Out is just for really, really excellent professional singers. Am I right?
Am I right about that? No, not at all. There's definitely learning about singing and whatnot, and that comes with it. But for sure, when I think of singing on stage, there's a whole lot that comes with it. And a lot of people have a lot of self-doubt, kind of like this block of concrete in your head that tells you so much about like being just critical of yourself. So a lot of the process is getting in there and just facing those fears that come along with getting on stage in front of people and singing.
What do people look like that first day when they come in a couple of months ago? And they know they're going to eventually have to sing on a stage in front of 350 people.
Well, there were varying degrees of terror.
And to say the least.
Yes, it's definitely, there are some kids who are really excited because this is their rock star fantasy come true. And then there are others of us who would rather do pretty much anything than sing in front of another human being. And you have that whole spectrum. So it was really great to sit and circle with all those people on that first day and hear everybody sigh in relief that they didn't have to sing the first day.
Right.
And it's amazing how far everybody's come since then.
And this year we're having it at a theater.
Yes.
And at the Libero.
At the Libero Theater. So this is really a professional experience. And it's very supportive because the band, Tina's band, is really wonderful, both in terms of being musicians, but also in being supportive. Understanding what this is all about. It's not about, you know, getting a platinum record. It's about getting up there and showing your friends and family and yourself that you have the courage to do something that you did not think you could do.
Yeah, a big part of their brilliance is they've been doing this with AHA for years, and they have this incredible gift for choosing, helping the teens and the facilitators, us, choose the right song. They really work to choose a song that's not necessarily a song that the person loves or that they feel like they can sing really well. It's more about the song that gets you to that breakthrough moment and opens your heart up.
Now, one of the things that AHA spends a great deal of time on is social-emotional intelligence, which is something that's unfortunately lacking, not only among teens, but among, I think, a lot of people in this country. How does the Sing It Out fit into that initiative?
I believe that it fits in so well in the sense that you are learning to be intelligent about your emotions and all that comes with that. Because when you are terrified, you tend to go into this mode where you're in this instinctive, protective, survival-based mindset. And you often do and say things that aren't, you know, who you are. And dealing and becoming smart about your emotions, which is what social emotional intelligence is all about, is really gives you a chance to conquer those and learn the tools and techniques that help you get through very stressful situations.
Right. Yeah. And the social part of it is really about building a community of support and an unconditional positive regard. So these kids come into this group every week knowing that they're going to be loved and supported and encouraged to really push themselves.
And you did this because you just love to sing, or you drafted into it? What made the two of you decide to do it this year?
Well, I've worked for AHA for a while, since 2011. And every year I would think, is this my year? And then every year it wasn't, and then this year it was. So I've kind of had this secret longing slash terror about doing this. And I've been a performer most of my life, as has Brandon, right?
You like to dance, and I play guitar, and I'm usually not in the limelight, so it's like such a new experience. And certainly, like, part of that is you're getting up on stage for probably like 5 minutes out of the group every time we meet every Thursday, and then the rest of it is like full-on supporting the others. Mm-hmm. Like, so you're really there and just engulfing everyone in love.
Yeah. And do you see the slow change in people, or is it just a dramatic change by the end? All of a sudden they suck it up, or is every week do the kids get more confident?
Well, it really depends on the kid and on the grown up. Like, I was actually the first one to just completely lose it while I was singing my song. Yeah. I got up on the first day we sang with just the karaoke without the vocals. I got up and started singing, and then I just fell on the floor, like, hysterical. I had no idea that was going to happen. And all the kids were looking at me like, oh my gosh, what is going on? And that was, so sometimes it happens like that. Mm-hmm. And after that, I just hit this new level of being comfortable. And then others, it's a much slower, more gradual process, would you say?
Yeah, Brandon? It definitely differs. And I definitely think of it as like you kind of plateau for a moment. Or especially for me, it's like I felt like, okay, I'm in a nice, happy place with this song and I'm working on it. And then it's something happens that's the catalyst that really just sends you to the next level. And all of a sudden you're there and you're like, whoa, I can't believe I did that. Sometimes you hear what you did. And I think for all of the youth that we see do it, they just like, sometimes they walk away just like, oh, I can't believe I did that. But when they reach that plateau and they get a little instruction on something about how to use their breath a little bit better, and then all of a sudden they realize something about what they're doing, and they reach this new plateau, and you see their eyes just light up. You can see them as they get off. It's just
and remember, you're listening to two professionals. These kids, some of these kids, and I know many of the kids from my dealings with AHA. When you meet them sometimes, they're unable to either look you in the eye or even say a whole sentence in front of a group. Right. And I've seen kids in that situation, and then I come to AHA, and I am astounded that they end up, you know, rocking. And it's really quite an experience.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure that all your listeners know that, you know, we've got American Idol, we've got Teen Star, we've got all these singing competitions. That's not what we're doing. Not everybody is going to be an incredible singer at the end of this, at the 13 weeks, but what you will see is people who are taking the biggest risk of their lives and doing everything they can to connect with the people in the audience and with each other. And that's the most beautiful part of it.
Does everybody follow the same? Does everybody pick like their own individual song, or
are they evolving it over the course? Are they changing the songs based on the songs they hear their friends singing, kind of thing?
It changes every time. So the first time we came in, they're like, okay, choose a song. And we would choose a song. We'd come in the next week, sing it. And right after that, like, they hear your voice. They hear, you know, just how you are and how you're expressing in your body and everything. And then they're like, okay, we want you to try this. It's a little different. Like, if you sang a little bit of a quieter song, now here's your chance to get a little out there and express yourself this way. And then you do that and you come back. Okay, choose a song. You know, but let's go in this turn, like choose something a little slower, a ballad, and it goes back and forth until they get a nice sense of the group and the show as a whole, and then they kind of put you into this song, and almost everyone was kind of like, oh, like they didn't really see themselves singing that song in the end.
Right.
But then as we progress through that for the next half of it, it's like all of a sudden they start doing things that they just never thought, and you see that light come out of them.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then you see the brilliance of the song choice that I didn't like my song at first, and now I totally get it.
Yeah. And this show, which is at the Arlington, still has tickets available.
It's actually at the Libero.
Libero.
Yes, mm-hmm. And their tickets are still available.
And tickets are as low as $12 for students. Is that
yes.
true?
Mm-hmm.
And $30 for adults?
Correct.
And what about for VIP tickets, which includes dinner?
Well, it includes the VIP tickets include what we are calling heavy appetizers because we can't think of another name for it. But like you don't have to eat dinner, but it's appetizers. Mm-hmm. And the VIP tickets are $130. And that starts at 6 p.m.
Yeah. And then there's we're selling 5 tickets for 1,000 apiece because then I will sing.
Oh, okay. You're
no,
on.
No, I take that back.
You're on.
I take it back. You know, it's funny because that would frighten me the most of anything. I can't imagine anything. And I can't imagine the audience would not feel the same way after they heard me. Anyway, guys, best of luck. I'm going to be there. I can't wait to hear you guys sing it out.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much, Melissa. And thank you, Brandon. And you've been listening and will be continue to hopefully listen to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB. And we'll be right back.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and San Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
More than 20 years now, the unique landscape and people of the Santa Barbara community have helped grow Deckers brands into the lifestyle footwear leaders they are today. Newly opened at their headquarters in Goleta, the Deckers brand showcase allows you to explore and shop the UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands while you're likely to discover something new or potentially receive an in-store special offer. At 250 Coromar Drive in Goleta, the showcase is open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 Monday through Saturday and 11 to 5 on Sunday.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers, in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative, social, emotional, and character building to help teens. We're here with Dr. Sean Anderson, professor and the incoming chair of the Environmental Science and Resource Management Program at Cal State University, Channel Islands. And as our regular listeners know, we had on several weeks ago the new president of Channel Islands, which is a wonderful school and a great asset to our community. It is probably the lead college university feeding nurses into Cottage Hospital. It has the only MBA program in town, and a substantial number of our high school graduates go there as a four-year school. And it's the closest CSU school to Santa Barbara of any school. So anyway, it's great to have you here.
Thank you,
Sean. I understand half of your title. I understand environmental science.
It's a bizarre name.
But what is resource management?
So when we created this program at the school, the idea was environmental science is a traditional discipline. Those are people going out measuring pollution in streams, that kind of stuff. Resource management is, while it sounds very similar, is historically been a distinct discipline wherein people manage deer, manage game, that kind of stuff. And these very, very different traditions, we were trying to build something different and bring together different, both people-focused environmental work as well as the more quantitative lab-based and rigorous science-based stuff, and we merged them together. So we created this super bizarre name. We don't ever – it's the longest name department on campus, so we just call it ESRM. That's our shorthand version.
So it's because it has the longest name, does that mean it's the best department on
campus? Well, I would like to think so. I would like to think it's a kick-butt program, but we actually really do. So one of the things that attracted me to this university and my wife several years ago now were the charter motivations for the school. We have these things called these four pillars. And I think our program really does a fantastic job of holding up those pillars. So these are – when I was interviewing years ago, I was having lunch with some of the folks that were interviewing me but not on my committee. And they said, where are you from? And I told them where I was from. And they said, what's your mission? And I said, what? What's your university mission? And I said, I don't know, to do research and teach, I think. I said, oh. Well, ours is to be student-centered, interdisciplinary, focus on multicultural, international, all these great things. And I said, yeah, no, totally, me too. I love that. And we had a little conversation. And 5 minutes goes by, and another person walks up, and they go, hey, where are you from? And I say where I'm from. And then they say, what's your university mission? And I said, well, I guess to research and do teaching. And they said, oh, ours is to be student-centered. And I thought, oh, my God, it's Jonestown here. Man, this is crazy, man. Everybody's drinking the Kool-Aid. This is all a setup, right? They've all been prepped. And I rapidly realized that it wasn't Jonestown, although we are in a former mental hospital, so I fit in really well. But it was this idea that we all – young faculty, old folks, everybody that was there really believes in this notion of trying to build a new university, a different type of university that has as its core student-focused education and service learning, service to the community, international perspectives, interdisciplinarity, all that great stuff. And we really walk the talk. So our program in particular really, really, really walks the talk when it comes to that.
And what's so interesting in the news the last 2 days is all of this talk about our current administration looking at education not as student-focused but as earnings-focused. The idea now is that – and in fact, the article was about the decline of humanities where – schools don't want to teach humanities because they don't feel they're going to be able to attract or be graded on how much money their graduates make when they graduate. So is that in conflict of this?
No, I don't think it's so I would say that there's always a bit of a tension on university campuses. Are we, educating a person to be the philosopher king? Are we educating a person to have a wonderful liberal arts, humanities focused background? Or are we producing someone that's going to graduate and make X number of dollars? And I think that tension is a healthy one. I don't think you want to go too far one way or the other. But in our case, what we've really tried to do in our particular department, I would say, is to really train students so when they graduate, they are ready to be employed field scientists. So we talk about theory and we do theory, but really we focus very much so on a lot of practical skills that they can graduate with and then go use. So we use drones, we use geographical information systems, we use all these things, but we don't just do the technical stuff. For us, the interdisciplinary is quite key. So the first 2 years, I don't see my students very much because they're out taking a year of economics, they're taking a year of chemistry, they're taking political science, they're taking all this interdisciplinary background that we think they have in order to properly deal with some of the environmental challenges that are coming down the pike. So all those things are incredibly important to us. In fact, we have a liberal studies major on campus, which is great. That's the only major that's more interdisciplinary than ours. So about 71% of our courses to graduate in my program, students have to take from folks outside literature of the environment and the English department, and it goes on and on. So those things are really key to us. And I would say that it's funny in that we didn't necessarily set out to get students employed per se. We were trying to just create excellent professionals and excellent citizens. But as a consequence of the preparation, our students do fantastically well. And we had a little bit of a dip before the recession. We had about 100% employment right when they graduated. Now we're about 92 to 94% in terms of when they graduate, they immediately go into the job market. And so that's fantastic. The ones that don't typically go to grad school or take a little break, but But yeah, I mean, I'm very proud of the program we've built. And I think that those, again, those conversations are important. Our students increasingly now are going into the high-tech field, actually. So my students are starting to go to San Diego now. They go to San Francisco to work in the drone industry because we do a lot of innovative stuff with robotics. And so if you want to use that metric, sure, you can use that. It's very interesting being at a brand new university in that all those metrics, they take years to acquire. And so when you try to compare us to these other places, we don't have, you know, 20 years of alumni, financial documents to figure out how much they make.
So when we look at resource management, it's not just understanding the biology mm-hmm. and the consequences to the environment. It's mm-hmm. also the ability to measure those consequences.
Absolutely.
So the skill set includes drones and
Absolutely.
Other technical sources of research materials. So it's not just, you don't have to just be a biologist to be
successful.
Correct.
That's correct. Yeah. So exactly. So I mean, for example, some of the service that we do. So when we moved down from the San Francisco Bay Area, the first thing we did, my wife and I was, I didn't say I want to do A, B, and C. I had ideas, but rather we went out and talked to the community. We talked to politicians. We talked to agencies. We talked to industry, and we said, hey, what are your guys' needs in, Santa Barbara, Ventura area? And so that's where we started our research. And some of that is traditional biological or ecological, environmental. Other stuff is public opinion polling. And let's get a sense for what people think. Did this activity work? Did this activity not work? Why do you think that worked? Why do you think that didn't work? How do we engage diverse groups in protected areas, in national parks, stuff like that? So all of that is within our purview.
And your degree is in which end of it? Is it biology?
Yeah,
or is it,
I'm a nerdy. Well, so it's interesting. So I am my PhD is I'm a marine population biologist by training. So I'm a marine biologist. But my undergraduate degree, I was at one point a triple major because I'm so I have a hard time settling down on things. But at the time, the environmental studies department at UCSB, which was where I was birthed, that was very much so a social sciences strong emphasis on philosophy, history, policy, that kind of stuff. And that's where I first was birthed, and that's where I thought I was going to be. And then some of my mentors challenged me, and especially when I was younger, the way you'd get me to do things is you'd say, oh, you probably couldn't do X, right? And I'd say, I can do X. Like, no, it's okay if you can't do it. I can do it. And so they challenged me to take some science courses. And I always loved natural history. I always loved being outside and camping and things. But I didn't always like science. I thought scientists were kind of lame. I thought they were boring people. I thought they mostly wore lab coats and hung out only inside and didn't have a good sense of humor. And so they challenged me to take a course in the biology department. And so I did, and I did fantastically well. And I said, oh, I like this. And so that's actually how I got into science was from being challenged to enter it. And when I took the last class of a guy named Joe Connell, who was retiring, sort of one of the fathers of modern ecology. And I got really interested in ecological restoration. Weren't doing any ecological restoration at UCSB back then when I was there. And so I knocked on a bunch of doors. It was the 40th door professor's door I knocked on and said, hey, I want to volunteer. Can I help out? And everybody said, oh, no, we don't have any paid jobs. And I said, well, that would be cool, but I just want some experience. No. And finally, the 40th one, they said, well, we don't have any money, but if you want to do some horrible crud jobs, you can do that. And I did, and I stuck with it, and that opened a million doors, sort of starting at the ground level, working up more and more. Eventually, I started doing research scuba diving, and that took me all around the world, actually.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and San Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
For more than 20 years now, the unique landscape and people of the Santa Barbara community have helped grow Deckers brands into the lifestyle footwear leaders they are today. Newly opened at their headquarters in Goleta, the Deckers brand showcase allows you to explore and shop the UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands while you're likely to discover something new or potentially receive an in-store special offer. At 250 Coromar Drive in Goleta, the showcase is open to the public 10 a.m. to 7, Monday through Saturday, and 11 to 5 on Sunday.
In 1962, Pierre Lafond founded the first post-prohibition commercial winery in Santa Barbara County. In 1972, he planted his first vineyard in the San Ynez Valley west of Buellton and later hired legendary winemaker Bruce McGuire to continue to build on the stellar reputation that Santa Barbara Winery has achieved for more than 50 years. Today, you're invited to experience the award-winning wines at Santa Barbara Winery at the corner of Yananali and Anacapa and the Lafond Winery at 6855 Santa Rosa Road in Buellton.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, improving attitude, creating social harmony, bridging the achievement gap for teens. We're here with Dr. Sean Anderson, professor and chairman of the Environmental Science and Resource Management Program at Cal State University, Channel Islands. Let's step back a minute. Are you from California originally?
I am. San Francisco, from San Francisco Bay Area. So I grew up there and then did undergrad at UCSB. And then ran a lab here for a little while after I graduated. And then I went to Antarctica for a while. Then was in went to UCLA, was it Los Angeles for several years. And then was up in the Bay Area at Stanford University for several years before we moved down to help start this university.
Okay, so CSU Channel Islands could be one of the most beautiful schools.
It's awesome.
So how does it compare to Stanford?
So I always say that the most
be careful though listening.
I'd say the most amazing the most beautiful campus I think I've been to, just in terms of uniqueness and stuff, is absolutely the Stanford campus. They have these incredible buildings, but I'd say we're a very close second. And I would say that especially for on a Cal State budget, which oftentimes we don't have the money for elegant buildings, we have an incredible campus. I mean, so our campus is built, for folks that haven't been there, was built, it was the largest thing our side of the Mississippi that was built by the Works Project Authority that was not a dam. So it was thousands of guys, 3 years to build this campus, and they molded it in the shape, they were inspired by missions. So everything is a quad within a quad. It's absolutely beautiful. And it everything's whitewashed walls. It looks, people from downtown Santa Barbara would very much feel at home there. Terracotta tiles. It's a beautiful place.
So I have this question for you, but I'm embarrassed to ask it because it's obvious. The question was, how do you make your classes dynamic for the students?
I think I have the answer to that. So it was interesting. When I used to pride myself before coming to Channel Islands, I used to pride myself, delude myself into thinking I was a good teacher. And I, you know, would go talk to kindergartens and I would talk to sixth grade kids and graduate students and all this and that. And I would dial it up or dial it down. When I came to Channel Islands, we have a very different student population than all of my previous universities. So we have a really, really diverse group of students. Some would be getting straight A's at UCLA and whatever. Some are totally not prepared for college. We have everybody in between. And so I had to learn to engage with folks that were coming in with different preparation levels. And so we've really structured our program in particular to take folks in because we're this weird name thing, ESRM. Like, what the heck's that, right? And so very few people come to our campus wanting to be an ESRM major, right? They come wanting – maybe interested in ecology, maybe something about politics or whatever. And they take one of our classes and they're like, oh, my gosh, this is what I want to do. So we're what my colleague Don Rodriguez calls a discovery major. So what that means is that's awesome. It also means we get a lot of students that aren't prepared in terms of a traditional STEM discipline. So we have to spend a lot of time working on their writing skills, working on their math skills, et cetera. And so that all that together has forced me to change my teaching modalities and to really adapt to them. And so, for example, I do a lot of screencasting, podcasting of my lectures. That allows us to go at a moderate pace. We still make sure everybody's together, but there's some kids that just need more review. They can go back and review that at their own leisure, right? And so it's access to them. When we first started doing that, I was told, oh, no, look, you have to have a transcript in there, and they have to be able to search it and find the term. And I said, you are totally high. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't want that. I want them to have to actively engage with the material. Mm-hmm. So stuff like that. Another key thing that we do in virtually all of our classes is we really embed
research throughout everything. So we're at Cal State, which you know ostensibly is a teaching university, and we are. We focus on teaching, but we have a huge amount of research that goes on. And so we, in our program, we embed research throughout. So that what I found initially when I first came down, I thought, oh, man, is that the right thing to do? Am I sort of pimping out students? Am I using students? Am I abusing students somehow, bringing them into research projects? And I found out through a series of experiments that absolutely it was the right thing to do. So they're more engaged. So by research, what I mean is monitoring roadkill, doing these public opinion poll surveys, looking at the health of our coastal strand, things like that that are within their wheelhouse, but we're asking them to do stuff because they know that this data would, maybe not this year, maybe not next year, maybe in 5 years or whatever, but help a county, help an agency, help a corporation, whatever it is, make some decision, they're much more engaged. Their test scores go way up. Their learning goes way up. Their engagement is just through the roof. And sort of using these different modalities to, you know, ostensibly reach out to them actually has all these tremendous benefits for the community as well as our students.
And what's the Pirate Lab?
The Pirate Lab. So, let's see. How do I describe this? So, we have always called my lab the Pacific Institute for Restoration Ecology. Mm-hmm. And long story short, let's see. How do I say this? Since everybody's listening, I would say that we had a policy on campus about centers and institutes. And I was reminded when I was on the cover of the front page of the LA Times, and there was reference to the Pacific Institute for Restoration Ecology, that was not an approved institute at the university. So please don't use that term. So we just started calling ourselves the Pirate Lab. And then people started saying, well, you think pirates? Yeah, what's up with that? And then when we started our robotics work with our flying drones and our underwater ROVs, my students named that division within my lab the Aerial and Aquatic Robotic Research Group. So it's the Pirate R. So,
speaking of pirates, the university has access to the Channel Islands.
We do, absolutely,
and that's very unique. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredible platform, if you will, for teaching.
It is. It's fantastic. So we have a research station on Santa Rosa Island, where it's one of only four such institutions in national parks across the U.S. So we're pretty rare and the only one that's undergraduate research focused. So our research station, anybody can come. Researchers from wherever can come. Just last week, there was a group from Westmont College. There's people coming from Nevada, people coming from Britain a few weeks ago. So basically what we have is we have a research station on Santa Rosa Island that's in the former bunkhouse. The previous operators had a hunting operation, and so we occupy that. And it's fantastic. We have traditional beds and rooms. We have tents. We have a whole series of facilities out there that are really built around interdisciplinary exploration. And so we have so people like my program is the heaviest user of that, but we have the biology department uses it, the English department. My wife, who's in the English department, takes out her freshman writing class out there, and they detach, right? So they cut themselves off from the internet and all that kind of good stuff, and they walk around, they reflect, they engage in meditation, they engage in research, they do all this kind of wonderful stuff as a reflective essay or as a reflective effort. We have we're part of networks that monitor the California coast. We have projects that are tied to the islands and the mainlands, and we're finally getting our first research boat. Right now we have to use Park Service boat and Island Packers, which are great transportation vessels, but soon we'll have our own research vessel that we can take our own groups of students out and move around the islands without needing to sort of borrow other people's vehicles.
Santa Barbara was not famous. Rather, it was infamous because it had one of the first ocean oil.
1969. Yep.
And just this last week, Venoco announced that they were giving the wells back to the state, whatever
right.
that means.
Right.
What does that mean ecologically?
Yeah, good question. Well, so actually that 1969 oil spill really birthed the program that I was eventually a part of, the environmental studies program at UCSB. It's the second oldest in the U.S. Only the Yale School of Forestry has something older. So oil has really been a huge part, as everybody from Santa Barbara will know, of the conversation of this part of our state. What's going on with Venoco? Venoco is a sort of daughter company, if you will, that was the descendant of the large oil companies that originally put in these wells and these exploration facilities, et cetera. They've been having a tough time. The real death blow for them, I think some of the narrative has been boiling up in the last week or two is all regulation, all the California regulations, all the county of Santa Barbara regulation on oil and gas production has been too much. And while that is a challenge for the oil companies, the real death knell has been economics. And so the Plains All-American pipeline that burst, that gave us our most recent large spill, the Refugio spill in 2015, that line is still not running. And so all these production facilities that Venoco had, they could not get that product to refineries, and they couldn't make money.
But my point is not so much whether Venoco is profitable or not, but how is there a danger that with no one watching those wells?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So what's going on? So for example, the Holly platform. So these offshore platforms that are in state waters, they've what's called quit claimed them. Mm-hmm. So they've filed a writ. This was 2 Mondays ago. And they basically said we are. So they already had filed for bankruptcy in the summer, but this was. But the idea was they were restructuring. They're hoping to come back. This was pretty much. Yeah, no, we're not coming back. So at that point, they essentially signed a legal document that says the state now has control of, for example, the offshore fields
and the responsibility.
Yes, and so what immediately happened was that the state immediately turned around and contracted with Venoco for, I believe it's 6 to 8 weeks, something like that, initially just to have their people still on the platforms and making sure that the generators are running, et cetera. Now the state is in the process of putting out to bid the project of essentially shutting in the well, of shutting those down. So one of their offshore platforms, I believe it was 32 different wellheads are going on right there. But this is going to happen across their holdings. And they also have some platforms in federal waters too that may well get shut down, but it's hard to know with the current administration how they will respond.
You're listening to HA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and Santa Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Deckers Brands, the parent company of global lifestyle footwear brands UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Anu, invite you to experience their new brand showcase firsthand in Goleta. Discover new product, try on a range of offerings from your favorite Deckers brand, and get a peek into the company's headquarters. The brand showcase is open for business Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. and from 11 to 5 on Sunday at 250 Coromar Drive in Goleta. See you out there.
Celebrating 50 years of serving loyal regular guests and first-time visitors, the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli invites you to enjoy their huge selection of fresh-baked sweets, cookies, carrot cake, muffins, and the famous farm cake, granola, Oreo popcorn, wine cake, homemade soups, and the popular fresh juice bar. Or get a coffee drink or fresh-squeezed juice and peruse the famous wall of greeting cards at the Pierre Lafond Market and Deli. Open 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, helping teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. We're here today with Dr. Sean Anderson, professor of the Environmental Science and Resource chairman of the Environmental Science and Resource Management Program at Cal State University in Channel Islands. We were talking about some of the consequences of Venoco quit claiming or abandoning the oil rigs in the harbor. And you know, over the years, it's not only been Carpinteria, Summerland, Katrina apparently
huge
has a huge amount of pipeline that has not been closed
That's
up.
Right.
So what is the risk for the entire environment because of that?
So
petroleum is a challenging subject. Petroleum is stuff that is, by and large, pretty toxic to most most critters. So there's a whole host of effects we see from oil exposure, from sort of aversion, things just sort of moving behaviorally going away, to things that can't get away getting exposed to this stuff, either dying outright or having sublethal effects. So there's all kinds of bad things that happen when we release oil into the environment. Now, we have places like Santa Barbara, for example, where we have oil that is naturally leaked into the environment, our tar seeps, for thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of years. In fact, that's one of the key distinguishing aspects of the Chumash culture is their tomos, their canoes, and they built their canoes, unlike virtually everybody else in the world, out of planks. Everybody else took animal skin, they took a tree and they hollowed it out. These guys just took planks and nailed them together, which normally wouldn't be seaworthy. But because we had so much tar just naturally on our beaches and everything, they would take that tar and they would make their canoes watertight. So in places like here, we have oil that has been sort of in the background, and microbial populations have basically adapted to deal with that. What we see in an oil spill, what you hear happens is people say, oh, the microbes will clean it up and it'll just be, you know, wipe our hands and it's good. That doesn't exactly happen typically at the scales we're talking about. But there are critters that can adapt to oil in the sense of when they're exposed for generations and generations, but most critters are harmed extensively when they're exposed to oil.
And how safe is the seafood in Santa Barbara, off the Gulf Coast, mm-hmm. Where the Horizon mm-hmm.
Deepwater Horizon?
Was, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, is there a long-lasting effect that's not just a matter of, you know, the right. beauty of the place, but it's the safety?
Right, so that's a great question. So we're still studying that. The short version is a lot of the initial impacts have gone away. One of the biggest problems we have in the Gulf, so unlike Santa Barbara, so not only do we have in the wake of the 1969 oil spill here in Santa Barbara, not only do we have things like the Environmental Defense Center and GU and all those kind of policy reactions, but we also have the birth of modern environmental monitoring. So people from UCSB, other groups went down and started monitoring the beaches and the intertidal, et cetera. So we have some baseline. The Gulf was the only place in the entire U.S. We had better monitoring in Antarctica. We still do not actively monitor what's going on. So we have the Gulf oil spill happens. Primarily, that's a methane release. It's not so much an oil droplet release. It's primarily a methane release. There's a whole long story. We have to spend an hour to get into the details. But the short version is that oil was exposed and trapped and contained in the midwater in the deep ocean. You don't have CNN down deep, right? You don't have Fox News down deep. So absolutely there was oil at the surface. That's what all the video cameras captured. And that's what everybody talks about. And it did impact the wetland and things like that. But really the big impact was in the midwater, deep water. That's affecting fish. That's affecting baby fish, larval fish. That's affecting jellyfish, all these things. And so what would happen is when I would go to meetings with folks and discuss what was going on, they would say, you know, Dr. Anderson, so what went on? I said, oh, you know, we nuked a gazillion million jellyfish. And they would say, oh, we nuked a gazillion million jellyfish? I'm like, yeah. All this oil was down there. It's clearly toxic. It smothered things, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'd say, oh, okay, thanks. So how many did we kill? So, oh, a gazillion million. Oh, sorry. Can you show me the data from 5 years beforehand about the jellyfish population in the Gulf of Mexico? And I said, well, we don't have any. Oh, you don't have any data? Oh, I'm sorry. Then, you know, yeah, I don't think there was an impact. And so when we move into this litigious world, and when folks that, let's say, maybe are not so interested in having a light footprint on the planet, when those folks get together and don't fund the monitoring, the baseline, you know, what is healthy, in other words, it's very hard to say what the impacts have been. So we can tell in the abstract, and increasingly we can tell in the specific, but it's a lot harder process.
Okay, so not to be always depressed in this conversation.
I'm a depressing dude.
Tell me your favorite environmental success story.
Ooh, favorite. There's so many. I would say one. Let's see. I know one. A quick one was when I was
an undergrad, the end of the world there was ozone depletion, right? And so as part of that—
I thought it still was.
It's getting way better. It's getting way better. And so that was a problem that seemed like we weren't going to solve it, right? Everybody liked to— – I don't have any hair anymore. But when I had hair, people had hair. They would put all those spray cans and, you know, make their hair go up, and they would do the underarm deodorant and all that kind of stuff and fire retardants, all these things that utilize so-called chlorofluorocarbon, CFCs. And the idea was, man, this is— – we use these compounds so much because they were inert. The very fact they were inert is what we liked about them. They didn't make you sick. They didn't do anything. But the problem was they were so inert, they would just go everywhere. And eventually they would get up into the upper atmosphere where ultraviolet radiation would hit them, break those compounds down, and it would essentially react and scavenge out the ozone that's high up in the atmosphere. Not the low-down ozone here that causes us air pollution stuff, but the high-up ozone that protects us from radiation from the sun. And so that was causing the so-called ozone hole over in Antarctica, et cetera. And so I was part of a group, Jand Bags, were here in Santa Barbara, and they hired our UCSB to create some environmental education stuff. So we made a flyer in one of their catalogs. This was probably like 1990, 1989, something like that. And it was great, and it was this, you know, wonderful way to do this research on this project, and it seemed like we couldn't solve it. Then we have the Montreal Protocol, and we basically solved that problem that nobody said we could do, that was international, require everybody collaborate, et cetera. That's a fantastic model for getting together, and even something that's a challenging financial thing, we were able to overcome that. We're able to make better, and that ozone hole is beginning to repair itself.
So speaking of successes, there's a character in the Journey Warner Brothers films called Sean Anderson.
Yeah.
Is he a relative of yours?
No, he was named after me. Sometimes have done some consulting for movies and stuff, and I was helping with some fact checking and things like that on that movie. And so my friend said, "Hey, we're gonna name the main character after you." And I said, "Great! The main character is a science guy, Brendan Fraser." Back when I had hair, people said I used to look like Brendan Fraser. We looked alike. And I said, "Ah, it's great! Brendan Fraser's playing me in a movie." And then I was flying up to where they're filming it in Montreal. I was like, "Great! I'm gonna go see Brendan Fraser." And my wife says, "Dude, I don't think Brendan Fraser is playing you." I said, yeah. There's a lady, there's a college professor, and there's a little kid. So clearly, I'm Brendan Fraser. I said, no, I think the kid is playing you. And I said, no, that's not possible. And so we go up, and sure enough, the kid was playing me. So, but it was good, but he's the only one that survived in a sequel, so that's good. So I am the eponymous Sean Anderson.
So can I still call you by your first name?
You can call me by whatever name you want.
Our listeners, we finally have a movie star on the show. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
Here's a question. Do you enjoy experiencing the best of Santa Barbara? Tasty restaurants, scenic hiking, local banking experts. That's right, local banking experts. Montecito Bank and Trust was voted best bank again by the Santa Barbara Independent, Santa Barbara News Press, and Santa Ynez Valley News Readers. Plus, they have over 40 years of experience, 10 branches from Solvang to Westlake, a convenient on-the-go mobile banking app, and a savvy team of local decision makers. Visit Montecito.bank today. Montecito Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Available only at the company's headquarters in Goleta, the new Deckers brand showcase features the latest footwear from UGG, Teva, Sanuk, Hoka, and Ahnu brands. You're invited to stop by to experience firsthand what makes Deckers brand so unique. Discover new product and try on a range of offerings from your favorite Deckers brand at their retail stores. Now open to the public 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and from 11 to 5 on Sunday at 250 Coramar Drive in Goleta.
You're invited to dine indoors or on the secluded garden patio, the sunny patio, or the covered creekside patio with fireplace at Pierre Lafond's Montecito Wine Bistro, where you'll enjoy the popular pizzas and many other dishes from the wood-burning oven, daily specials from Chef Victor, and selections from the elevated wine menu featuring Lafond and Santa Barbara Winery wines. Open daily at 11 for lunch, wine, cocktails, dinner, incredible desserts, and a daily happy hour from 3 to 6 with very unique appetizers, in the Plaza del Sol, Montecito Village.
Habitat for Humanity of Southern Santa Barbara County is building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. Habitat has completed construction on 19 new homes for affordable homeownership. We'll build 3 new affordable homes this spring and has repaired over 35 homes through the A Brush with Kindness program. To learn more about how you can support Habitat by volunteering, donating, or shopping at the Habitat Restore, visit sbhabitat.org or call 692-2226.
Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA helps teens manage their emotions, support their peers, and serve their community. We're here with Dr. Sean Anderson, professor and the incoming chair of the Environmental Science and Resource Management Program at Cal State University at Chinal Allen's. So I can't not ask this question, but there are things called facts and there are alternative facts. Now, let me get this straight. Does the university – which one of those two does the university teach?
I usually teach real facts. Unless it's like, you know, a Friday night and it's very late or something like that.
Okay. So now you're a teacher of real facts. Now, how has the political climate influenced not only the number of students you're getting, but but the kind of students you're getting? I mean, we, you know, we have two different cultures in this country. Are we just getting people who believe in what we think are important, or are we actually getting a group of people that we can maybe have a dialogue?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really proud of the fact that our program is really structured to, that I like to hear from everyone. We like to bring in the oil companies and the environmentalists. We like to bring in everybody, and I let my students make up their mind. We're not a program that has a particular political agenda or anything like that. Also, my students come from a variety of backgrounds. So we have a large proportion of, for example, military veterans and active duty military in our university, but also especially in my program, and a whole wide range of folks. So I like the fact that our university is a welcoming place to all different perspectives. We're not on one side or the other. Having said that, it is a challenging time to be engaged in several of these issues that we are involved with things like oil spills, et cetera. The politicization is insane, is absolutely amazing.
Just yesterday or today, Trump signed an order, or is going to sign an order, getting rid of the protections for many, many national monuments.
Yes, yes, absolutely insane, absolutely crazy. And so there is reasoned, and there is differences of opinion. It's difficult because I try to always keep my personal opinions out of what's going on, but it's quite obvious that several of the individuals that are in key positions with agencies, for example, that influence the things that I work on, they don't necessarily believe the reports. They have taken efforts, for example, the EPA, to delete some findings about the toxicity of pesticides and just straight up delete those reports. Now, this is nothing new. This has happened in the past, but what's different now is the magnitude and the holistic, wholesale just attacking of things that we assumed were bipartisan. And so, I mean, national parks and national monuments are a classic example. Now, there are folks, there's always been folks in the last many decades in the Western U.S. that feel like they want to have more say in the federal lands around them, and that's a conversation we can have. But to simply delete the provisions of the Antiquities Act and other things is absolutely crazy.
And the driver, they claim, is business over the environment. And
that's a false that's an insane false dichotomy.
Right. It's like killing animals in Africa and expect tourists to come, which is their biggest business.
this notion – I mean, my students make way more money working on wind turbines than they do in the other industries. They make way more money in the drone industry and all these other things we're training them to be. So this notion of this or that is wrong. It's rather we're evolving into something different, just like we don't plow the fields with cows anymore, right? That's not a bad thing necessarily. And so, I think that false dichotomy is being packaged and represented, and it's baloney.
So final question, what do you I mean, how would you 20 years from now, looking back at your career, what would make you happy that you achieved?
I'm really proud of the students that we've created. So at my previous university, I had a lot of wonderful students. They were mostly from the same socioeconomic background. They were mostly going to be fine no matter what I did. They mostly went into academia. Here, my students mostly graduate. They stay in Santa Barbara, Ventura, Los Angeles County, and they work for agencies. They work for private companies. And I love the fact that they are making an on-the-ground impact in environmental quality, environmental justice, education, all that stuff. So I'm most proud of my students.
And I think for those listening that are looking for a place to make a contribution, Chinal Allen's not only educates our kids, but they provide our businesses here and our government agencies with people who can actually do the job to keep the place going.
Absolutely.
Sean, thank you so much. Thank you for all you do.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. You've been listening to AHA Presents About Education, and we'll be back here next week at the same time.